Hello and welcome to You Set the Tone, the podcast that takes an X-ray to the medical drama show ER. We examine the show with surgical precision and celebrate the high pressure and beating hearts of the show. My name is Sharon.
My name is Ed.
And I'm Sean.
And this week we're looking at season 4, episode 10, Do You See What I See?
And I think I do, Sharon.
Do you see what I see?
Yes. How apt is it that for our first episode of December 2021, it's the Christmas episode of ER?
Exactly. I was thinking exactly the same thing. Yay. I was like, we're almost synchronized, but I remember when next year will be not, you know, maybe a bit close. No, we won't.
That's all right. It's cool.
Think about the weeks now.
Gosh, do you know what? We could, if we go plus 52, so your average season's about 20-ish episodes. Yeah. So we're about halfway through this one. So yeah we'll be what? Into season 6 by Christmas 2022.
Wow.
So we could be talking about Lucy for Christmas. Oh, Lucy. No, it's just mid season 6, I think. Mid sort of start to mid.
Well, that sounds about right then, because we have 10-ish more weeks of this. 10 or 12 mm-hmm. more weeks. Then we've got 22. That brings us to about 34. We could be looking at, like, you know, Christmas.
I mean, it's a party. So
it most certainly is. And somebody has, oh my God, such a good time. You know? Not so much Lucy and Carter.
Season four.
What is great about this episode? I mean, there's a lot of great things, but I love how it opens and it opens and it kind of, what's the word? It like tricks you because you hear Carol waking Doug up. So you figure they're home.
Yes, I thought that too.
She's like, you know, Doug, wake up. And then when he kind of finally gets up, you realise they're in the hospital. And I love that because I thought that's that trope that we've discussed before. Yeah. Waking one of the doctors up or waking one of the nurses up. And it's all happening there because we haven't had that for a while. So I really liked that. It's a really cute moment between the pair of them. You know, they're talking about their schedules. He's busy. She's busy. They're talking about trying to get time off together. And she makes the schedule. So he's very much like, can't you just, you know, run around and say to people, you know, I make the schedule. Therefore, I'm off on all the good days. But she's like, no, it makes it harder. And she points out, and this is definitely something that happens to people. It's like, oh, you're single, therefore you have no life, therefore you can work all the holidays, which is what's been happening to her because she hasn't been able to basically come clean about her and Doug. What I love, though, is this is Carol's problem, isn't it? It's not a Doug. Doug has at no point said, we need to keep this quiet. This is all coming from her. And he's like, come on, I've said, go talk about it. Let's go and tell everybody, you know, he wants to shout it from the, you know, the mountaintops, I guess. But I just thought it was just a really sweet, gentle start to this episode with them two.
Yeah, no, I agree. Obviously, like, you know me, I love seeing the two of them together. I think they just make me happy and smiley. Mm-hmm. And I love that Doug just kind of, just takes the kind of the moment to say, you know, I'm going to stick around, right?
I'm not going anywhere. Mm-hmm. Oh,
I wonder if that's hard for him or if he really accepts that he'd messed up so much the first time that this is a bit of penance for him, or is he getting to the point where he's like, come on, what more can I do to get her to really...
In fairness, that's a good point. Like, you know, how long do you pay for your sins before you start to go like, listen, Carol, I'm kind of getting a bit frustrated now. But he does definitely seem to respect, like, I understand why you're being hesitant. I understand why you're not rushing in. But it's still so nice just to see them together.
It is. It's sweet.
I was just, when she kisses him, I was just like, I don't know which side I wanted to be on, whether I wanted to be Carol or wanted to be Doug. Do you know?
Both. The magic of them.
Both.
Yeah.
I mean, they're not my dream thruple. Obviously, we know that's Abby and Luca, but...
I mean, that's good too. Pretty much anyone. Anyone, really.
I think that we must have said this before, but they feel like the iconic couple in ER.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of great love stories throughout ER for me, but this is my favourite. I think the way that this is handled is one of the best. You know, there's not this sense of, like, with a lot of the others, we get this, oh God, we've got to do something with them. Quick, break them up. Oh, let's put them back together. Oh, let's break them up. Yeah. Oh, let's put this guy with that woman. And let, you know, and there's a lot of that that happens later on. Whereas I feel like these two worked together for ages, but they were pining for each other, and especially Doug. And now they're together, and that's kind of how it moves along, which is...
Yeah, there is a bit of a soap opera revolving door at the end, isn't there? Especially Gates. Yeah. And Sam as well. I really like Sam. I really like the actor, but they do...
I just think that it's funny, actually, because my sister's been rewatching ER, and she's been messaging me things about it, and she's like... It just, at moments, and I think I completely agree with her, it's like they go... Oh, we don't really know what to do with this character, or we haven't really thought it out. Quick, there's a man, put her with him and let that person. And then they go, actually, we don't want them two together. And then in the end, this, you know, somebody like Gates has dated everybody, somebody like Luca has dated everybody, and it just feels, I don't know, like, I'm not saying it cheapens anything, but I think there are some couples that they've definitely put together or created obstacles where they didn't need to.
Mila.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is a big bugbear of mine.
As I know.
We will discuss.
Mila and Gates.
Well, Neela and Gates and Neela and Gallant, I'm not here.
Yeah, they didn't give him a chance, Gallant, I don't think.
I thought he was, I mean, I found him to be just such a dull.
Yeah, that's what I mean. He's,
anyway.
It's kind of like, you know, when you've done the washing up, but you leave the water in the sink.
Yeah.
And you kind of go away and you do something and you come back to that water and you're like, oh yeah, that's Gallant.
Exactly that, and I feel like there was something maybe to do with contracts of different actors, possibly, and not knowing who was going to stay and who was going to go, so they kind of moved stuff around. Then it was, oh no, actually that person we can have back. Oh shit, we've got her married to, I don't know. Anyway,
anyway, back to season four again. Sorry.
Right, which character would you like to go with? I'm going to give you guys a choice.
You go first, one shot. Oh, he's going to.
As if he would wait. As if he would wait.
I know, right?
Sharon, would you like to go first?
No, Sean, I'm teasing. I'm just doing that for effect.
Yeah, go on, Sean. You had somebody you wanted to discuss first.
I was actually thinking, what about Corday?
Yes, let's do Corday.
Yes. It's always lovely starting with her anyway. Doing anything that involves Corday makes me a very happy person. But also, it's also a relatively short but important plot this episode.
Very true.
Because it not only advances her story, it gives us a little more insight into Romano.
Yes. And some of that creepiness starts as well with
yes, it does.
Which
is
so uncomfortable. But
the braces, right?
Anyway. Because obviously last week we saw, you know, Alison Beaumont had come in, her mom had passed away. Corday took her to try and save her leg, basically, and ended up, she was in a coma. So she feels a lot of guilt, and she's leaving to go home for Christmas back to the UK. But she's kind of popped in to do some notes. And I imagine as well, as part of that, is she'll probably want to have a little look in on Alison. But Romano's there and he says to her, oh, we're going to do the next surgery. You're here, you know, scrubbing. She feels very trepidatious. And I think it's one of those things where, because she doesn't completely trust she did what she did for the right reasons, she feels a bit hard to face it possibly and actually be there in the room. Although, I mean, they're brilliant at what they do, and they've got a funky little piece of kit where they're both kind of looking in through a whatever that is and looking right down into her and trying to fix everything. So
it's a bone graft, isn't it? Which sounds heavy.
Yeah, it does. And it sounds like it's going to be quite a complicated surgery. And, you know, we've got this kind of, we know how Corday has been feeling about all this anyway. Because there's that moment where she's watching she's kind of outside and she's looking in on Alison, who's obviously, you know, in her bed, and Benton comes up and she's still really beating herself up about it and just, you know, saying, oh, you know, I'm the one who put her in a coma. I feel like running in there and telling her, but that will do nothing but make, you know, me feel better or whatever, or probably not even that. And he actually says, and I thought this was so lovely and so comforting, you know, he kind of just says, bad things happen to people, but you did your job. Because I think at the end of the day, somebody subjective and outside of it can see that. And I think that's what it is, isn't it? I think,
yes, definitely.
I think she did do her job. And I think the girl would really appreciate the fact, the length she went to keep her from, you know, keep her leg, basically, is what I would say.
Yeah.
No, I agree. Because, and in a way, it's sort of a, not so much a mirror of what Benton was saying last week, but there is a shade of that. Like, Benton obviously is a much nicer person. Officially, we don't officially know this yet, but Benton is a much nicer person than Romano is. And you know that when he says, you know, you did your job, you know, there is a moment when you have to ask yourself, what's about the glory and what's about helping the patient? You know that he's doing it from a, I understand you point of view. Whereas Romano's like, you did your job. Next.
She's alive.
Like, why are we talking about this?
Yeah. Why is that even a consideration? She's there, she's alive. And we get to actually, well, you know, what's amazing is she wakes up from the coma, doesn't she? And Alison Beaumont does, and Corday, who's been trying to leave all day, but things keep stopping. She, you know, she finds out she's woken up and she runs over, because this is the first time in, is it 10 days, I think, she's been.
Yeah, and the nurse kind of says, oh, yeah, she's awake, as if it's not a big deal, not realising she's been in a coma.
Yeah.
And we've seen this nurse many times. Is this, that's not Shirley, is it? No, it's not Shirley.
No, Shirley's older.
I think you're right, sorry. In fact, I'm sure you're right, because I trust you. But I try to think of, we have, there's this nurse and Shirley, I think, are the two most frequently seen OR nurses. So it was a bit surprising, like, you know, oh, she's awake. It's like, hang on, you've been in enough episodes that you know you probably should have rang Corday. You probably should have come and grabbed her.
Yeah.
Plot fails aside. She says it, and Corday runs, and we have this lovely moment where she's desperately trying to communicate with her, and they get a pen and paper, and she asks about her mom, and poor Corday has to kind of obviously deliver that news. And that must be tough, because there's nobody else there. It's not like she's got a therapist or anybody to kind of help out. It's literally she's just telling her while she's already kind of waking up from a coma and not knowing what other damage is going on.
She was actually, I was watching this this episode with a friend of mine who has never seen ER. She was laughing, going like, oh, this is the first time I've ever seen it. I was like, that's an achievement, because she would be the same age as us. So, you know, there was a moment of like, George Clooney looks nice. I'm like, yes, he does.
Yes.
But we got to the scene. She got really excited because, oh, it's Professor River Song.
Of course.
Yeah.
And there are, of course, two scenes in this episode where someone has to deliver the news of someone has passed away to a family member, and this is one of them. And she said, oh, that was it was just straight away, and it was so calm, and it was, here's the news, you know, because Alison writes to her mom, she goes, I'm sorry, your mother didn't say it. There's no hesitation, there's no, we'll talk to you in a while about that, you know?
Yeah.
We're
not going to tell you right now. We'll let's change the subject so we can tell you later. Or and it's like, I don't know if this scene's happened or if I'm remembering wrong, but I know that they talk about delivering bad news and it being very definite, and, you know, you leave no room for questioning, or, you know, we did everything, they are gone. You have to be very definite about the fact that this person is no longer with us.
It was earlier. It was Benton and Carter.
He was a medical student.
That's right. So you're right. So we get that moment, and then she takes the tube out, which must have felt, you know, wonderful for poor Alison, but Alison can't seem to speak. And what I think Corday does brilliantly here is she just carries on talking to her, and he's just like, oh, you know, it'll be, this is what happens, you've had it in your throat for like 10 days, I'll just get you ice chips. And she kind of walks off and makes a call, doesn't she? And I thought that again was handled really well, because she didn't alarm Alison at any point.
Oh my God. I mean, I'm trying to think of things that she might say, you know, oh, I'll get a doctor. Oh, I'll do this. Oh, I'll do that. You know, kind of, oh, panic. She's like, I'll get you some ice chips. You chill out there for a second. We can talk about, okay, you know, your mom has passed away. We can start to talk about how long it's been. We can start to talk about like kind of what's the date today. Yeah, we can talk about that. You know, there's, yeah, it's just handled so well because, and it's funny because in a way, this is a one-sided almost friendship because Corday yeah. has spent every, you know, spare moment she can by Allison's bed for the last couple of weeks. Yeah. For Allison, it's been minutes.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And also a bit like, who are you? Because I don't.
Yeah. Really, she never, she didn't see. Yeah. I don't think she was still conscious when Corday was in the room.
No. Oh, well, I think she was, but we just don't know how much she would have remembered from such a traumatic kind of moment. Because she was kind of so busy asking about her mum while she was down in the ER. Yeah. And in the end, you know, Corday doesn't, she doesn't go. She chooses to stay, which I thought was, again, just really sweet. And she's called, you know, she calls the surgeon to come and help. And everybody's saying, oh, come on, it's Christmas Eve. He's not going to come kind of thing. And she's just like, I'm going to wait anyway. And I just thought, again, you know, that she knows that this poor girl has nobody else in the world, I imagine, because we haven't seen any of the family members or anybody come while she's been in a coma. We haven't seen Corday talking to anybody else about this case, like, oh, you're the aunt or you're the sister, you know, so it feels a bit like she's alone in the world. So maybe that is also a factor for Corday to be like, I think she feels like she couldn't get on a plane and leave and not just worry about her the whole time, I imagine, or feel bad that she'd left her. So I imagine that that's what it was more than anything, her needing to be there and be that constant support and to make sure she gets the care, because she feels kind of guilty, I guess, in some ways, but also because she's her doctor. So
definitely. It would have bugged her.
Yeah. And there's that lovely, you know, they have that little montage at the end, as they often do in these kinds of episodes. And we see that she's sitting with the surgeon does turn up. He's looking at Allison and Corday's right there, right by the side, and it's dark, it's late, you know, and that's just what she's chosen to do.
I know. It's, she stuck around and she has to spend Christmas in Chicago basically on her own.
Yeah.
But she does get invited in the hospital or invited to a party with Brisis Romano.
Solid pass.
Yeah. He was practically salivating as he asked.
Oh, no.
And then he did that weird thing where he like touched. Oh, that made me feel really sick, because I've had that happen to me, and you kind of freeze and you don't know what to do. And you're like, is this actually happening? And this doesn't feel right, but it feels innocuous enough, but it feels really bad and wrong. And I just felt so many things when I watched that moment. I was just repulsed mostly, though. I was like, oh, Romano, no.
Yeah, I think this is the first moment, because I mean, in the grand scheme of all roads lead to Romano, I think this is only like episode 4 that he's in.
And so,
something like that,
this is kind of like, oh, maybe you're not a good guy. Like, maybe you're not just I push buttons kind of guy. Which we've seen him be push buttons kind of guy. And you can, you know, if we didn't know, because not only, sorry, I'm also giving spoilers, because listeners, if you go through this for the first time, you need to be warned.
Yes. I mean,
Romano's lovely.
I think we've talked about it enough in my love-hate relationship with Dr. Romano as a character and as a concept. I think we're not spoiling it too much by saying he might be a bit of a bastard later on.
Dun, dun, dun. So that's the kinds of things we introduce. We see Benton on one side being really lovely, and we see Romano being a bit weird, because doesn't he make a quip about what people owe each other or something really weird when they're in the surgery? There's something he says, and I remember thinking, this just feels weird. But I feel like Elizabeth's getting the sense of him, because when he kind of asks her, she's very much
something about, and consequences, because she leans out from around they have the microscope that they're looking down, and she goes, yes, and Allison is dealing with our consequences now. That's I remember, that's her reply.
That's
and he just kind of goes, and kind of goes back to what he's doing, you know. It is funny because in a way he's very archetypal, and obviously we'll discuss that in greater detail in future episodes, but they've eased him in a tiny bit.
Yeah.
Like, this is the first one where I'm just like, you're a dick. You know, there's other times where it's just like, that wasn't very nice. It's like, no, this is like, this is bad. Stop that now.
Yes.
Yeah. It crosses lines, doesn't it?
I mean, there's a little bit of that with the lad with the seats in Versus. The lad with the mirror organs and Romano's pressuring of Benton about the researchers with scientists.
That's what we do. Yeah.
Yeah, but at the same time, you're healers
and humans, and everybody's a human. And well, and I imagine the way Corday managed to get the sign off for that was by being human. Yeah. I just felt like she was able to talk to the dad in a way that he understood. It was for the greater good rather than just being like, sign it, do it, you know. And I mean, we see that. I think that's one of the things. You get these doctors and you get some that are just so caring and really a human about it. And you get ones that just don't understand that side and are quite robotic about that, or quite who cares about that. And Romano definitely falls into that second category.
Romano is a glory hog. Problem solver. Like, that's why I think he went into surgery, is that I can solve problems and then tell people I've solved them.
Yeah.
Whereas you have other problem solvers who don't lack that humanity, you know, but just might not have the people skills.
Yeah.
For example, Benton is lovely, but there are some weeks you're just like, Benton, please go away.
Be human.
You've done an incredible job here, but could you go away now? Let somebody else talk to the family.
Yes, gosh, yes, yeah, absolutely.
So I have a question to ponder over the coming weeks and months about Romano.
Okay.
And I'm wary of being a pop psychologist about this. Do you think Romano could be a psychopath?
Psycho or socio?
I think they're used interchangeably a bit, but I might be wrong. But psychopath is in, he doesn't see people as people, he sees them as units, as meat, for want of a better term.
Yeah, and I could see that, sure.
And he's very, I don't know if narcissism is necessarily a psychopathic trait, but there are elements of that and being able to manipulate people around him. And the only sign we do see him break that kind of behaviour later on with
Lucy.
Didn't want to spoil it.
And his dog,
but again, it's just something to think about over the next few weeks. I wonder if they wrote him with those ideas that he is, I don't want to say high functioning, that's the right term, but one of those psychopaths.
It's possible. I'll tell you what, I will meet your challenge, and I will do my little bit of research on psychopathy and what kind of falls into the qualifications, because I can, with the very little I know, I can certainly see some aspects of his character would fit that, and sociopath as well. I hear you that sometimes they're used interchangeably. I am not qualified in any way. I will do my homework.
This is also the, I'm basically creating the book that John Ronson wrote by everybody deciding they can diagnose psychopathy from a 20 question
that
test,
book,
which it is a brilliant book. And it does. Sharon's shaking her head. Do you disagree?
No, just
this is not fair.
Somebody asked me a question from there and I answered it, and they said, oh my god, you're a psychopath because you got this question. And I was thinking, and I got really nervous about why it was I'd answered that question, and I realized it's because it comes up in 30 Rock and I'm not actually a psychopath. It's just something that happened in 30 Rock and I must have just remembered it and been like, this is the answer.
All right. So just for context, the question was, at what point do you take your foot off a drowning person's head? And you said, when the bubbles stop.
Yeah.
You know?
Exactly. You know it.
The correct answer was, why would your foot be on their head in the first place? You know, there's two different ways of coming at that.
The question, if you wanted to know, was the one about how, so you're at one of your parents' funeral, and a really handsome person comes and you fall in love with them and you need to know who they are, and they go away, you don't know how to get in touch with them. So your answer to that, what's your answer to trying to find them again? And the idea is that you would then kill your second parent so that this person would come again. And it happens in 30 Rock that Jenna falls in love with a paramedic.
Yes.
And so she keeps putting Kenneth in harm's way. And they're like, well, just so that he comes back, and he keeps like feeding him strawberries, which he's allergic to. And that's what that was. But that's why
it made me a psychopath. I'm like, that's really clever.
isn't it? Like,
yeah. There are many points to that. And also, if you worry that you might be psychopath, you're definitely not a psychopath.
Excellent. Good. I do worry.
What if you worry that you're not a psychopath? But anyway, sorry. Right. Let's
yeah. Segueing.
I'm going to segue into Benton because I really love him this week. I think he's just, I mean, I feel like this is such a, I mean, he's quite a big part of this week. You know, he is. I mean, when we first see him, he's on the street and he is struggling with all the bags he could, you know, more toys than I think Santa probably has in his own sack. And he's dropping them all over the snow-covered floors as Anna runs up to help him. And they're all for the baby. They're all for Reese because, you know, he wants to, he basically knows that the sister, you know, Jackie, his sister, will spoil him because he's got the baby for Christmas, he says. And it's the first Christmas and he knows Jackie will spoil him. So he's gone and brought like everything known to man, which I'm loving this side of Benton. You know, he's just, it's this soft, gooey center that just makes me go all like, oh, this is lovely. And then were you going to say something?
I was going to say, like, it's both wonderful and dreadful, this storyline this week. But I do put emphasis on the wonderful side of dreadful. Okay. I do like it. The only thing, I have a big note, right? Here's my big editor's note for this storyline for this week.
Are you listening, scriptwriters of ER from the 90s? Carry on.
Did you need to include the sound effect? There was two moments where Benton places his hand on something. And there's a little, it's like the opening sound effect from Back to the Future. It's like, and something seemingly magical happens straight away after. And I was sitting there, and again, fresh pair of eyes beside me going, really? I was just like, okay, cheesy. That is. And I was defending, going, it doesn't normally do that. It doesn't normally do that. Yeah. I was kind of like, come on now.
Cheese.
Come on now. Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess the part you're referring to is, you know, Benton and Anna get to the ambulance bay where an ambulance is there. They're bringing a man out who, you know, is not well. And Benton basically touches his head. And all of a sudden the guy freaks out because he can see. And he's like, I can see. And he starts, you know, naming things that he can see in things, and then later he calls, you know, he says to about Benton, he's a miracle worker, and there's this whole him and Benton and Anna just don't believe that he was ever blind. That's what it is, really. So when he's saying, oh, I can see you, you're a black man wearing yellow, this is happening, you know, that's happening, they're just like, oh, I don't understand what his game is, what is it that he wants.
Yeah, it's interesting because again, this is in a way, it's like, think of, you know, Demerol seekers, or, you know, people who will come in with stories, you know, in a, obviously this is kind of played for comedy, but in a very serious storyline, they come in with story and it's like, what's your angle? So he immediately gets kind of lumped in with, well, like, what's he going to start looking for? Or, you know, what's he going to ask for? Is it going to be, oh my God, I can see again. And it was only because I got all of this Narcan. Or, you know, like, oh, well, I best we better give you some more that, you know.
Or to start a cult or something. Yes, I can see and I can heal you too, you know, just, you know, they're very whatever. And then we get Anna, who's actually looked into it. She's obviously been quite interested in the case. So she went and researched the guy and realizes actually he was blind. It's there. It's in his chart. The guy has gone left, M-A-M-A. So they can't really do anything about him and they're still a bit puzzled. But Benton's kind of shrugging it off a bit because I guess he's a man of science and this isn't going to be something that he's going to want to spend any time thinking about. And especially because it puts him in kind of a central place, which I don't think he particularly enjoys, you know, people looking at him and seeing him and seeking things in that way from him, you know. And all through the shift, you know, different people come in looking for him or asking him to touch them. We
make
do
me
get,
walk again, you know.
Yeah, like, exactly. Yeah. And we get this moment with the cleaner who we haven't seen for, you know, since the live episode.
I know. It's your man. He's back.
He's back with his you know, floor polisher, and it's not working, and it's 13 years old, and what can he do? But him and Benton have a really sweet conversation about Christmas and about how it's the first one for Reese, and you know, Benton's looking forward to it, and the cleaner guy is like, you know what? You've got to hold on, enjoy these times, because as they get older, they don't want to hang out with you anymore, you know, all that kind of stuff. And then Benton kind of taps him on the shoulder, and all of a sudden, the machine works. Which, I don't know.
Yeah, okay. I mean,
okay.
Sure, why not?
Yeah. I'm going to go, yes, okay, fine. I'm going to suspend my disbelief because it's Christmas and it's magic and I'm on board for all of that stuff. But also, it's weird. Yes. And then later, you know, he's talking, well, the guy comes back in and he can't see anymore, and they're trying all the tricks on it, you know, trying to get him to see if they can do anything, and Benton calls down, you know, the kind of the brain surgeon who says, oh, he's got a tumor, so actually he should never have been able to see. She's very much, he's lying. And Benton's very like, he can't, because the way he describes stuff, stuff he would never have been able to know. And as an audience, you're kind of left with the idea of, you get to decide what, I don't know. They don't give you an answer. They don't go, this is what it was. You just have to kind of have a bit of faith if you want to believe it or figure it out. I don't know. Maybe not figure out. Just one of those unexplained things, maybe.
I like it in a way, like it. I obviously, they don't, we don't, no one knows the medical side of all of this, but you know, I suppose it can be wrapped up in, look, strange things happen. Would you go in rounds twist? Sorry, strange.
Oh god, I'm gonna be speaking in an Australian accent all evening.
Could I rack off, right? Sorry, I don't know if I just swore there anyway.
Sean will try as well,
and in a way, it's just a Christmas miracle. And in the same way that people in comas for 20 years sometimes wake up. Yeah.
And that storyline.
Ooh, don't know what you're talking about. Ooh,
that's cool.
So, and there the man Bart, he delivers this beautiful little speech. It's basically about seize the moment. That's pretty much what it's about.
Yeah.
You know, this afternoon I was able to see. You know, I watched the snow falling. I played with my dog. I can't remember the dog's name. Santos. So cute. Santos. Brilliant. Yeah. Actually, I remember thinking it's Santos Little Helper.
exactly.
And he was just like, and that was it, you know. And then they kind of, there's a moment of, you know, at the beginning of that, well, we'll talk about treatment and, you know, it's operable and everything, which by the sounds of things, it's incredible that it's operable. It's been around for like 5 or 6 years.
I know. And then she was talking about how big it was. I was like, oh, wow, okay.
It was like, oh, wow. The fact that he's still... It's a bit like that, again, now to quote another comedy, it's a bit like that skit from Family Guy, and it cuts to Popeye is there talking to the doctor, and he's got the massive forearms like Popeye does.
Yeah, yeah.
And the doctor's like, you know, kind of like, you've been carrying massive tumours around in your forearms for the last 50 years. The fact that you've been walking and talking is nothing short of a miracle. and it was like a bit like that. But it is, it's very, very sweet. Even though it is bittersweet because he's gone back to being blind again, and by the sounds of things, as Peter says, look, there's a chance you might regain your sight, but you know, I think we're sort of left with the impression that he is going to try, he is going to go for treatment. And as this episode shows, stranger things have happened.
It reminded me of, and I've seen these stories over the years, and I'm not quoting them as scientific facts.
Watch out.
They may be apocryphal, but it's about people who've...
Is this are we taking some drugs section of this week's episode? Is this...
No, yeah. No. I did consider it. I did ask a friend of the show, Dr. Martin, about it, but I think he's far too rational and stuff to even mention. And like this. But you hear stories about people who have been blind for years and they bang their head and something in their brain or in their optic nerve has just shifted slightly. And then the sight comes back or their sense of smell comes back, because actually what they'd done years ago as a kid is stuff something up their nose and it blocks their nasal passage. And they
also a 30 Rock episode character.
Is it?
Yeah.
Oh, really? I bet they, maybe they got that from life or vice versa. This story was influenced, you know. But then it also reminded me randomly of a woman who said she was a psychic and was very successful. And then she got smacked in the head at a garden centre and tried to sue the garden centre for loss of her psychic powers because they disappeared after she got smacked in the head. It just popped into my head randomly.
And what did they say? No, because you should have figured that out.
Yes, I was just going to say that.
That's the case. Get Herb to be back up here if you need to.
But no, they did find in favour of the defendant on that one. They didn't, because it was like essentially what the court is saying, that psychic, if they find in her favour, that psychic, in the eyes of the law, her ability is legitimate. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's just me going on a random brain segue.
And then we get this, so we kind of have that whole storyline, and then at the end of the episode, the montage is kind of all based around Benton as he's leaving for the day, and he's kind of watching all the snowfall, and then he's watching all his colleagues kind of singing, and he's got all his bags still full of kind of all the toys, and it ends on a kind of a hopeful, happy note, which I think is really sweet. And you know, the song that the title refers to is playing, and for me, Benton felt very much like the kind of needle and thread through this episode. Like, he was kind of the core, and then all the other stuff was happening around him, which and it was cute. And I don't mind storylines like this at Christmas, I have to say. I want to believe in magic, and I want to believe in good fun. You know, why not? Let's, you know, what's that Roald Dahl quote? Those who don't believe in magic won't see it, kind of. It's one of those type of,
yeah, I think I know what you mean. Yeah,
I do believe in fairies. I do, yeah, believe in fairies,
exactly. Yeah. And so that's kind of Benton this week, you know, a bit gentle, bit of a sweet, yeah, sweet moment. Where should we go next? Where should we go next? I just don't know.
I think we should go to Mark. Because that's an awkward one. Let's get out of the way so we can talk about Carter.
Yeah, that's true.
Yes, that's a good point. Mark has quite an interesting week.
Yeah.
A lot happens sort of around him, and then a couple of things happen including him.
Yeah.
If you know what I mean. So we have... actually, I suppose we should say that... maybe a trigger warning for listeners here, because there is a storyline this week that it's tough. It deals with rape and, I suppose, elder abuse as well. Yeah. So a patient is brought into the ER, an elderly woman. She has been, there's been a home invasion. She's been attacked and she has been sexually assaulted. It is again, I just feel this is an ongoing storyline, so we will be revisiting this in the next few episodes. Mark, one of his storylines this week is, not only does he straight away deliver as much care as possible, but you can see how triggered he is straight away, because it brings memories of his own assault back.
Mm. And Carol, because Carol's asking, isn't she? Yeah. She's asking. And it's interesting because he's obviously the doctor, and he's trying to treat her. So the lady, Mrs. Larkin, is there, and Carol's trying to talk to her, ask her questions, and Green comes in at it from a very weird non-doctorly way, and he says, you know, tell Carol as much as you can, because then we, you know, more chance of being able to catch the guy. And Carol looks a bit shocked, and she's like, no, and also it will help treat you. Like, he's completely forgotten about that layer. He's so, oh god, we've got to catch the guy because of his trauma.
Mark, for this season, obviously, we've finally got to a stage where we kind of like Mark again. And he steps away before he becomes too, like, Mark, she's not ready for these questions right now.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And he does step away before it gets to there.
Which shows the growth, doesn't it, with
him? It does. There's, and just to sort of follow Mark sort of out of the room for a moment, which is not to leave this storyline straight away, but just to follow Mark out for a moment, we see that there's actually a couple of parts of his storyline this week sort of lead him to a front door by the end of the episode. A comedy aspect, really, is we get another appearance from Herb Spivak. Dana Days. He's kind of getting a photo where he's reliving his glory moments shocking a patient back to life, and that's very funny. And, you know, he's like, oh, pose for a picture, Mark. And Mark's like, you know, kind of no. And he goes, hey, look, I've made your lawsuit disappear. He's like, oh, yeah. And he goes, and they didn't want anything. Ah, they wanted an apology. But look, I told them it wasn't happening. Yeah. And you can see his mark is like, so he's got that in his head. So at this stage, he's kind of going, oh, shoot, all they want is an apology. Then he's presented with a much more serious reminder of his own assault.
Yeah.
Then in a way, now, this is not related to his assault per se, but his discovery, I suppose, that, you know, Cynthia reveals that she has been keeping the fact that she has a son called, I believe, Jason.
Jason.
Yeah. Jason. Yeah. From him. She wanted to, from, you could tell she was trying to put her best self forward, and she felt that being, you know, having a child wasn't her best self. So Mark is kind of a bit like, oh, hang on now. I've got, first of all, I've got this going on. I mean, I know this is a lot because I had to turn around and explain to my friend. It's like, well, actually, no, he has a daughter, but she has known that since the first moment.
Yeah.
Whereas she's chosen to keep. So it's not the fact that she's a single mom. That's not the issue. It's the fact that she's.
He's not mean. He's just, it's just an added complication. But also I think he, you know, him and Cynthia have been, he's been trying to keep it as clean and easy as and light as possible. And for these kinds of stories to start coming out, you're getting more and more serious. You know, if you're starting to know that she has a kid and she hasn't seen the kid for how many years and she's going to send the kid stuff. He also pays off her credit card bill, which again, I thought was like a bit dangerous.
$600. I mean, it's not a massive credit card bill, but it's still $600.
You're still tying yourself. You're still doing something that, if he felt about her the way Doug and Carol feel about each other, different, but because he doesn't and he keeps kind of doing these big grand things, you know, the diamond necklace and then this and sweeping her off, let's go to my, you know, here's some lingerie and you're going to spend the night at mine all these times. And we know how he feels about Cynthia. We know what Cynthia's like. It just feels uncomfortable to watch because you know that he's just doing it to make things easy and to be the kind of, I can solve this problem. I'll just do it without really thinking about what that means and what that means to her. And, you know, I felt really uncomfortable during like all of that. I was like, oh no. Oh, it's a bit like, I'm your daddy. I'll sort it out. You know,
kind of.
It's another layer of that sort of dependent carer, which is you never want to be a carer in what is supposed to be a relationship. What I mean in the, you know, kind of, I need you to look after me as opposed to, oh, we look after each other.
Exactly. You know? It should be like an equal thing rather than, I'm the man, the status and the money and the this and the that. And you are not.
And... yeah, so when he's leaving the hospital, so there's another scene with himself and Mrs. Larkin.
Where he's patching her up, and it's just him and her at this point, isn't it?
And this is kind quite, of yeah.
Well, we've seen some moments where he's been talking to the cops, haven't we? And he's very you know, really involved in the case. And at one point they have to say to him, you know, we can't tell you stuff because this is an ongoing investigation. Mm-hmm. And
that's our first clue as well. It's like, oh, she's not the first victim.
Yeah, exactly. Which is hideous. And you kind of see his cynicism at the police because, you know, they're very much like, don't worry, we're on it. We're going to catch him. And they walk off and he's like, yeah, right, kind of thing. So we've seen that as well. And then he goes in to deal with Mrs. Larkin and it's just him and Mrs. Larkin. And she's talking about how she's going to miss Mass, where she plays the organ at Mass, and she's going to miss it. And it's been too late for them to find someone else. You know, she's talking about other stuff and he's very much like, you know, that's the last thing you need to think about. And she's like, no, I don't want to think about or talk about the other thing, you know. But then she starts to talk to him more about the feelings around it and how scared she was and how horrible it was and how angry she was about it and that it's happened and how angry she is at this attacker. But she says she doesn't, you know, she has to forgive him.
It's that
moment, isn't it?
In a way, it's... And I do mean this in a positive light, right? So one of the things behind Christianity, behind a lot of religion is, you know, kind of learn to forgive, you know, don't carry these things. And she's going, like, we know that she plays church and mass. So from a religious point of view, like, you know, I must forgive, I must not carry this. And in a way, this is like the ultimate test of that. If you can forgive this person, then, you know, mm-hmm. you can forgive anyone. And then Mark is absolutely right, you know, from a humanist standpoint, going, you do not need to forgive this person. You are absolutely allowed to hate this person. And while it is, of course, about Mrs. Larkin's attack and her attacker, this is also, of course, Mark and his attacker.
Yes.
He is going, you're allowed to hate. You're allowed to hang on to these feelings. And she's like, but you know, I want to basically get rid of these feelings. And there is a sort of a light bulb moment for Mark. You know, it's a bit like, well, she's right.
Yeah.
You know, not that necessarily we go around forgiving everyone, but there's things I'm holding on to that I don't need to hold on to. Yeah. Or I'm giving them much more power than they actually warrant.
And I think that's what I liked about it. I liked that she wasn't just, because it started off very much like she was just being, I need to forgive because it's my religion. That's what I've been told. But when she actually, and so I had a bit of a reaction like Mark did, you know, you need to do what you need to do, whatever it is for you, not what somebody else is telling you need to do. So if you're ready to forgive, that's for me is very different, which is kind of the reaction he had. And then she kind of says no and explains why her holding on to it and how useless it is, and you know, bringing her down. And as you say, you know, Mark is sitting there and he's starting to really reevaluate kind of his own anger and trauma and what he's held. And he goes immediately from this room and he goes to Weaver and says, I'm going early. I need to go do something. And as you say, we see him at the front door of, you know, and we're just like, oh gosh, where is he? I mean, maybe you guess, I don't know, but he's at a front door and he knocks and a lady opens a door and he's like, oh, it's, and she's like, I know who you are.
Yeah.
And she kind of shuts the door in his face. And then Chris Law, who was the brother of Kenny, who was obviously the brother who was killed, you know, he comes out and they have this really, I don't know, good exchange, in the sense that they really both able to kind of air stuff out. And it's the first time that Green actually in front of them, instead of being defensive, he owns up to it. He says, I'm not sure if it was an assumption or racism. It was probably both. He doesn't sweep it across. He doesn't go, but it doesn't matter. Or I'm saying that's to get away from the racism. He actually owns up to it by saying it's probably both.
Yep.
And he really realizes that. He says to him, he says, I know it wasn't you who attacked me. I think I used you for my anger. And that's what he was doing. He was channeling all his anger on his attack at Chris Law, because he's thinking that he'd done it when he hadn't. And maybe when he came to the realization it wasn't Chris, it was still easier to hold on to that than rather than to accept the pain and to accept the wrongdoing that Green had kind of done. You know, it justified it to him. Oh, look, he's a bad kid anyway, or whatever. But then Chris says this thing, which I just thought, you know, he's very much like, I was glad when I found out you got it. You know, he doesn't sugarcoat it or hide it. And then he says, but at the end of the day, my brother's still dead and there's just no meaning in that. And I thought, that's what it is. Nobody has won, you know. It was senseless, it was hideous. And then Mark's attack was senseless and hideous. And nobody is winning. But what this moment may give, because then Green actually apologizes, and people think sorry doesn't mean a lot, but God, you know, that just a sorry is somebody going, I hold up my hands to what I did, that I did something.
Yeah.
The comfort that can give, that is, it's such a powerful word, and it can make somebody, I don't know, it can really ease somebody who's been hurt by whatever your actions are that you have gone, because sometimes as well, when bad things happen, you think, have I made it bigger in my head? Yeah. And somebody says, no, I'm sorry. You go, I wasn't mad to like be mad at you.
It's acknowledgement of pain, isn't it? I see your pain. I'm sorry I caused it or I create it in any way.
Yeah. Yes. And you are valid, and what you were feeling was valid.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I am sorry. And we know that they're not going to be hanging out, and they're not best friends, and they're not, it's not completely over, but I think it's done something for them to both be able to maybe close the door on it a bit and not. Maybe now Kenny can think about his brother without thinking about Mark, and maybe Mark can let go a bit of the fact that and learn from it and move forward. Because as much as we've liked him again and he's been a bit nicer and stuff, you know, he still hasn't been 100%. And I think this is that, isn't it? It's that moment where he's done what he needed to do to kind of have closure on this moment. and this horrible set of events. And now hopefully he can heal. And then we see him at the end and he's kind of lying in Cynthia's lap and they both look so miserable. I thought, yeah, Merry Christmas. Merry Christmas.
We wish you a Merry Christmas. And we won't make it to New Year. Sorry.
Well, that's it. That's it. And I just think, oh, you know, I for me, it felt like good. Maybe now we can move past all of this. Yeah. This is their way of going. That's done. Let's draw a line. And maybe we'll get proper green back. That's my hope, you know.
I think I know exactly what you mean, but I love this. So that whole bit, like you're saying about there's no good ending to this. This lad died for no reason.
Yeah.
And I think that's so many times in shows, there's this idea of fate or destiny, even not said out loud, but, you know, oh, it's all reconciled and they like a neat type bow. But there is no neat bow to this tragedy.
There isn't.
And having this rewatch, because you always get this idea of Mark as being the good guy.
Yes.
And I'm really appreciating that, no, they could have easily copped out a little bit and made him the good guy.
Yeah.
But he's not. And by his own admission, do you know what? I think my attitude was stunk. And it's one of those moments where you go, this is one of the best shows on TV ever because everybody's well-rounded.
Mm. There's and they a don't reason shy away. It won all of the Emmys.
And they don't shy away at all from that. This to me was what the most important thing about having Green put his hands up and say it was probably racism was, is something so important that people are only now really starting to have conversations about, but people of color especially always were having conversations, is to be racist doesn't mean you're walking down the street with your, you know, with a Nazi sign on and you're swearing at black people and
fights crosses
and the way it can stuff. how it's built into the world is that it means it's in people and they don't always know or they don't, and that's what this showed. This went, actually, this is what it can look like. Here's Mark, who is a good guy, but actually at this point his judgment that he used was flawed, and we're all human, and that's what it looks like. I think that's what for me was really important, because it's been so hard over the years to say to people that, you know, that I've felt some racism or that's racist, or you felt something, can people kind of go, well, no, they've got their arm around their black friend, or they haven't got an NF sticker on them, or, you know, there's that real sense of having to really try and prove it. So this storyline was just great. Okay, so we've got a few different ones to go. So we've got kind of Carol, we've got Jeannie and Weaver, which is they're all sweet, and we've got Carter, which is less sweet, a bit more. Where do we want to go next?
I would, just because it's Christmas, do you want to do Carter now so that we can sort of end on a sweeter note?
Yes. And actually, with Carter, we're going to talk about who, for me, is my favourite of this episode, which is Henry, because he is just so funny George, in this episode. Just he like everything that is going on is just brilliant. So, let's go there. So we start with Carter, you know, and it's actually Carol's talking to him about the fact that his grandma's coming in, and so we learn that she's coming in, and, you know, what snacks and stuff, and Carter's just like, oh, you know, whatever, you know, not really being that helpful. Well,
whatever being like canapes, you know, the usual stuff,
the usual caviar.
When does the catering staff arrive? I'm sure they'll look after her.
Foie gras, everything served on crystal. And that's where we find Henry comes down, and he's back for another stab at trying to get his ER. And in his mind, he's only has one thing to do, which is a big procedure. Once he gets that, he's done. Carter's very much like, yeah, that's what you think, kind of, which I thought was funny. So, but he's brought his own gloves this time, so that's good.
Good.
We've got Henry with his own gloves.
Yeah.
What could go wrong? Well, every single...
Nobody survived.
Yeah, it's like that episode of Father Ted where oh, God, I haven't seen it for a while. What's his name? The dumb one.
Oh.
Dougal. When he has to do the funeral and he ends up with fire.
Recently, it only popped up for me.
Oh, it's one of my favorites.
You let Dougal do a funeral.
There's just like standing there like, I don't know. There's like the caskets over around. There's a fire over there. Yeah, people are running. That luckily doesn't happen, but it could have been that for Henry.
Could have been, yeah.
It could have been. Yeah. Well, so the first person that comes in is actually a little kid. He was trying to climb up the chimney because he wanted to prove that Santa could do it. He comes in with the firefighters, brought him in, and he's obviously got a lot of issues with soot inhalation. And Henry's ready. He's ready to cut this kid open and do what needs to be done. And everybody's like, calm. You can't. And actually, this is the first. Now, I don't know if we have to take money out of the jar, but they say this is not a good teaching case.
We can spend it. That's what that means.
Yeah.
On Grey's Anatomy. The book, not the...
And then... so that was a brilliant moment, I thought. And then later when Carter's kind of outside talking about something, Henry runs out and he's like... I've got this guy. He needs a spinal tap. And you know that this guy, poor guy, has probably just walked in and coughed.
A hangnail or something.
Yeah. He's like, I'm ready. I'm ready. Just sign off. Carter's like, it's a stomach flu. Like, you know, he's so trigger happy this whole episode, Henry, which is what makes me laugh. He's ready to, because then finally when somebody it's funny does come in.
And terrifying.
Yes.
I wouldn't want him to treat you.
Never at any point. And he kind of, you know, when a guy finally comes in who's suffering from a heart attack and they're trying to you know, he finally has a procedure he could do. He's taking too long to listen to what the guy's saying and also to kind of just taking ages. And in the end, you know, he gets pushed to the side and Carter has to kind of help, you know, save him.
It's funny because is it three in a row or two in a row where he's like, I'm all good to go? No. I'm all good to go. No.
Yeah.
And then eventually Carter. And then this, I mean, I suppose, obviously, in the grand scheme of things, this poor man comes in and, he's not very, he's quite poorly. Yes. And he's whispering and he's trying to say something. And, you know, Henry leans in and then Henry's all good to go. Here we go. And the man rudely dies.
Just dies.
Just so inconsiderate. And Henry's like, I was going to bag him. and we had our guest as well. And we'll get to this storyline. But yes, Dr. West was in the room. And Dr. West kind of says, listen, you'll have to step aside now.
I'm calling it. No, there's nothing you can do. And he leaves. And Carter doesn't care that this guy's dead. He's like, you know what? It's probably safer if you do it on somebody dead. So he's like, he says to Connie, he starts saying to Henry, and Connie's kind of looking at him like, and then she says, I'm going to go get the death kit. Like, I'm out of this. And then he starts letting him kind of do, you know, procedures or start to do procedures just as kind of the brother walks in. Don't break his teeth,
vocalize the cord. And then
the brother walks in and he's like, oh my God, is he going to make it? And Carter says, yes. And I was like, why are you saying yes?
Ridiculous.
It was like, Carter, oh no, Carter. Yeah. He's like, yeah, we're doing everything we can. We're doing everything we can. You know, relying on, and I know it's played for comedy, but relying on the fact that this brother's going to be so traumatized, they won't remember that there was two very young looking doctors, no nurses and no sounds in the room. Actually, if I look at my memory, he wasn't hooked up to anything either.
And his belly wasn't going up and down and he was getting a bit blue in the lips.
I'm sure he was fine.
And then we get that brilliant moment where, you know, they're going to tell the family and Carter's standing there with Henry, and the wife is obviously very distressed and Henry's trying to make her feel better. It's okay, you know, he was thinking of you. His last words were that he loved you, Maria. And she's like, I'm not Maria. And they go, Maria's Joseph's wife. And everyone looks over at this woman. Looks like an elf, the way she's dressed, the colours she's dressed
in.
And it was like, damn, that is probably the nicest thing that Henry's ever done. And it blew up in his face.
Yeah.
Yep.
Completely. And Carter's kind of looking at him like, what have you done? And poor Henry, wasn't his fault, you know.
He didn't know. This will be a nice thing to leave them with. It's a sad moment. Yeah. Here's some nice news. Oh, well, I made one of them smile.
Yeah, that's true. One out of two ain't bad. But at the end, he gets his Christmas wish. You know, Carter's filled out the form and he says to him, you're done. And he shakes his hand and he says, promise me one thing, you will not practice anything like medicine. I want you to be brain research, the end. And he agrees to that. So, you know.
Like, which is like, everybody wins because he was quite good at research. He knew what he was at. That's fine.
Yeah.
It's when you go near patients, it's when people tend to die. So if you could not do that, that would be great.
And he is not immune to that because he almost died.
Exactly. That's when you know it's not personal.
Yeah. And I think as well, you know, this is a greater good for the people of Chicago, because anybody walking by, Henry was ready to cut open for this procedure. You know, there's that person's perfectly healthy. No, they need a liver transplant and I'm here. You know, it was getting to that level, which
I think
was
so
scary.
I think so.
And now we can turn to Carter fully. So his big storyline this week is that Gamma and Chase are here to watch, well, to kind of see the clinic in action. And Chase has been brought along because Gramps didn't want to come. So Chase is dressed up, you know, as Santa Claus. They have this really brilliant moment where they're bringing in loads of toys and Carter's like, who are these for? And he's like, I don't know. Grandma just said, bring lots of toys. You know, we'll go.
Yeah.
Give them to the kids upstairs. But they talk about the fact that Carter says, oh, you know, I'll be over tonight and Gramps will talk to me about my wasted life in medicine. And I thought, it's just so funny how they see the world and like he's wasting his life because he's treating people.
It is just honestly like only this, as is portrayed in this, only the super rich could look at being a doctor and be like, oh, what a joke. And then I think Chase manages to get a funny joke and he says, I was like, yeah, but from his point of view, he still thinks you're a surgeon.
Yeah.
It's like, whoa.
I got a minute. So already we're kind of dreading this after work party thing that he has to go to. Chase disappears in the middle of everything and Gamma says, you know, go find him because I want to go and we need to, you know, leave. So Carter goes off and finds him in the limo. And what is he doing?
I know.
This was like, I must say, I do remember this storyline. This was a gut punch because I swear she's the fourth person on the podcast this evening. Anna was watching it and she thought just as Carter was going to open the door, she's like, oh, what's he going to be? Is he going to be doing a line or, you know, is he going to be smoking or anything? And he opens the door and he's there injecting directly into his arm. I mean, it was like, oh, wow.
That is way past anything. Like, you kind of expect like a rich person might do a line of coke here and there and be functional and carry on with their lives, but when you're getting into intravenous drugs, I mean, that you are far gone. And we have this moment where kind of Carter sits in there and he starts realizing and he's like, that wasn't a spider bite, you know. And it's starting to dawn on him how deep this problem is, and Chase is like, it's fine, it's under control, you know.
And you do it on board, and it's pure grade stuff I get from the right guy. It's like it's artisanal hipster heroin.
Exactly.
Yeah. And as Carter says, like, what, like that? Would like that makes any difference?
You know? Even calls it a little stocking stuff, and I'm like,
oh yeah, like it's nothing. That he's just sticking something in his. And I think as well, what's really just like, the way that Chase is just like, oh, it's fine, it's all under control. And Carter's like, that's what every single junkie who comes in through my door says. And you know what? You think I'm getting it artisanally and I'm doing all this stuff and I've got it, but you're not. You are the same as that person because you're both addicted and you're both, you know, shooting up.
What is the difference is, I mean, he's not in a suit. That's it. That's the difference. And if you don't see that, you're a fool.
Yeah, exactly. Or in a limo, you know. Well, the thing I have to say about the limo is, should it really be parked there? Shouldn't that be? Isn't that where ambulance
totally
is?
Not. No way should that be parked in there. Because not only should cars not be parked in there anyway, the limo's going to take up so much space.
Exactly. And it's not easy to maneuver around things. It's not a zippy little thing. So
I think what happened the last time there was a car in there, Jerry blew it up with a rocket launcher.
If only Jerry was here now, we could sort out the Chase problem once and for all.
Yeah.
Gamma, could you just hold back for a second?
Yeah. Just stay here. So Carter's obviously found out and he's got all these denials and he's very shocked, very upset, very, you know, disappointed. He then kind of says to Anna later, you know, what are you doing for Christmas? I'm going to hang out. I'd rather hang out with you. I'm not going. So he's not actually doesn't go to his the party because I think he just can't stomach seeing Chase.
Pretending like everything's fine when it isn't.
Being in that world, which is just hideous. So it's a tough week for Carter because that's a horrible thing to kind of figure to learn about somebody, isn't it? And somebody you love or you. And the way that I think the way he lied to him about the spider bite, I think Carter thinks, God, I'm so stupid for just trust. You must have been laughing at me for trusting you.
I need a bit of help, my sure. My doctor cousin will look after that, you know. You know, if any, and you could just think he obviously believes he's Superman and nothing can go wrong. But sure, even if it does, Carter's got me.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. There's an element of that. And who wants to kind of be part of that? That's just horrible. So
yes,
tough
is,
week for Carter. Tough week.
Yeah. It is. It's unpleasant. Now, Gamma Carter.
Yeah.
So to bring something positive from the Carter name, sorry, John, but to bring something positive from the Carter associated name this week. So she comes in to see the clinic and Carol is quite literally fighting fires around her. Running this way and that. Gamma overhears her saying, you know, there's a customer saying, I've been here for hours and, you know, kind of what the heck. And thankfully, Jeannie is volunteering to help today. Otherwise, Carol will be completely swamped. Somehow, I don't know how, but somehow this is Cynthia's fault.
She put up the old decorations, didn't she? She put up all the old stuff. That's what it was. Yeah. And that's why it was on fire.
Oh, the electrical.
Well, it's brilliant because Carol is like fighting fires and kind of swirling around, trying to make everything calm as everything just falls apart around her. And then, you know, Jeannie takes it, Gamma sits in and watches Jeannie as Jeannie's like talking to different patients and this girl has come in and she's a teenager and she's pregnant. She's also kind of had a lot of sexual partners. So Jeannie's saying to her, you know, you should think about doing a HIV test. And she has that classic line of I don't sleep with junkies or gay men.
Yeah.
And this is where Jeannie says, neither did I. And it's
It is a
brilliant line.
And obviously we know, like, Gamma Carter's just like, bloody hell, what is going on in this hospital?
Yeah.
Whereas we're like, what a massive step for Jeannie as a character, you know, because now we know she has come to terms, but now she's able to go, I can actually help people who might be either in this position or might be putting themselves in the path to being in this position. And if I could do something to stop that without it being I will give you a big massive lecture and do-do-do-do. It's like, just take a test. That's all I'm asking you.
And she's changing the face as well of HIV. She's going, it's not just, you know, actually it happened to me and I was straight and I was this and you see me in this hospital and I'm successful. Yeah. And it changes the teenager's mind. She kind of hears that and she says, okay, fine. How long will it take? Blah, 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 you know. And actually Jeannie earlier in the day as well, she it kind of in that vein is she's treating a junkie and she's actually taking needles from the hospital to give to him because a weaver catches her and she says, I'm doing this because, you know, I don't want him to be getting worse, to any of them to be getting hepatitis or worse or anything else. And they have a little moment, don't they, where because Carrie's like, that's illegal. And she's like, well, he's not going to report me, are you? Which just shows how
their relationship is like, it's so on the rocks. Now, this episode, I would have said going into this episode that, you know, the rocks are 5 miles back that way. You know, they'd have to work up to get to a relationship on the rocks at this stage. But this episode, The Magic of Christmas, does manage to not necessarily turn it around completely, but maybe flings a life buoy out there because there is this scene. And like she does say to Carrie, and you kind of think, will Carrie report her?
Well, yeah, you know? Exactly. Yeah. She could. And then get rid of her that way, you know.
And then, you know, Jeannie's there. Her alarm goes off. She goes to her locker. And another sign, actually, funny enough, another sign of how much she has come to terms with living with the virus is that she has managed to forget just long enough that she's left her meds at home.
Yeah.
And even that, obviously, don't forget your meds. But even that's a step.
Yes.
That it's not the front and center of her mind at all times of every day. And so she realizes, but then the flip side of that is like, it's really serious. You have to take these meds at the same time.
You can't miss a day. You can't miss one dose.
You just can't. It just, like, you know, the virus, if it gets a chance, it kind of rebounds and, you know, can become resistant. So she doesn't hesitate. She goes straight to Carrie. And initially Carrie is like, I'm busy. I'm doing the, in the scale of ER jobs. Don't you see how busy I am? I'm doing the lowest of the low.
Yeah.
And she just goes, no, Carrie, I need to talk to you right now. And I can't wait. And Carrie's kind of like, hold on a second. And she says, I've missed my meds. I need a dose. Doesn't blink. Straight into the medicine cabinet. And I went,
yeah.
Oh, I liked that.
Yeah.
There was no, when it comes to that. So it's like, maybe personally, we have issues at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And, but at the end of the day, you need your meds. What am I going to do? Say no.
Yeah, exactly. I think it reminded them both of how human each other is, you know, because I think when you're angry with somebody, you're fighting, it's easy to forget that side and forget your friendship and just focus on the anger and what's negative. And it's a moment for them both to go, oh, gosh, you know, hang on a minute. When it all comes down to it, we're these humans and we're there to support each other. And it's actually really sweet because at the end, Weaver and Ellis are leaving and Jeannie walks past them and she says, Merry Christmas, Kerry. And she says, Merry Christmas. And it's just this, like, it's that thawing of that ice, isn't it? It's just that, like, they might be okay after all, you know, from such a sweet little
the capacity moment. Is there. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, to go back to Gamma, where we were. Sorry, I took us on a Weaver.
Oh yeah, you're right. Of course, Gamma.
Sorry, yeah. I got excited. And it's a bit scary because obviously Gamma's in there. You know, she's here to do a test, you know, to check everything out. This is the kind of thing that could pull funding, especially if you think about, you know, like an affluent kind of rich white woman. She might be like, oh, conservative, I can't, you know, have anything or like that.
Do we want the foundation's name on this?
Yeah. Exactly. So she kind of come. Well, we don't know what she thinks because she's kind of looked shocked. Then we see her and she says to Carter, I'm going to make a phone call. And you're like,
I'm out of here.
Her and Chase leave. And then later Carol's kind of, you know, working away thinking, oh God, you know, what happened? I don't know what she thought, what was going on. And a guy comes in and says, oh, you Carol Hathaway, I've got a delivery for you. And they take her outside and there's a gorgeous tree all being lit up and it gives her a card. Again, I was a bit like, this is also still the ambulance bay.
Yeah, a little bit.
It's a bit awkward, right?
But also, okay, it's Christmas, I'll accept it because it's really pretty.
You'll allow it, yeah.
I'll allow it for this. But I was a bit like, is that not still the ambulance bay? And Carol opens the envelope, which has got a card from the Carter Foundation and a check for $150,000, which obviously shows that Gamma did approve and didn't mind. And I think maybe quite liked the fact that Jeannie did what she did and is... Mm. It just showed that she wasn't one of those rich people who were like, oh, I'll just put money on things and have my name and fill out, you know. It showed real care about what she puts money into, and that something that might be a bit controversial to others, to her was like, great, I'm going to help even more. You know, she's not going to step away from that. And I think it really shows you what kind of the mettle of this woman and this strength and this.
She's cool. She's down with the kids.
Matriarch.
Like, you know, she's,
She's like, oh, I know what HIV is. I almost slept with JFK in the 60s, you know. She's not shocked by things, as we like to think she might possibly be.
I suppose for historical accuracy, we are neither confirming nor not confirming that JFK was HIV positive.
Meant kind of it. From she was from we the don't world.
Know
we don't it's know possible. That's true it's yeah. possible anything is possible so that's really sweet moment there for kind of for Carol.
It is it's lovely and it's lovely. Nearly everyone obviously in that side of the storyline, some of the characters less so, but have a good week with that Jeannie. Even Carrie has a bloody good week.
I know. When we first see her, she's in a hotel room that looks debauched. You know, they've had fun in there. And
fair play to her.
And Ellis comes out all dripping from the water in the shower. And she looks like a mermaid, kind of like with the sheet on her. And she turns all glamorous, looking sexy. She's obviously having the time of her life with this hunk this kind of synergic man.
Did I hear it correctly? She was like, yep, I will be taking you up on that offer. I will be meeting you at the airport.
Exactly. Yeah. So she's going to go, you know, on this trip to do work. And I say work in inverted commas, because we know it's more of a trip, kind of hanging out on the beach and, you know, all that stuff.
There are still jobs that can be done in that bit of work as well.
Well, there you go. Exactly. Because Ellis turns up at the ER, doesn't he? And he's like, I'm here today to kind of cover. Yeah. And I'm here to make sure you get on the plane and all that stuff. And it's quite nice to see Kerry happy for once and having something good in her personal life. Because she's always been work. We've got to see it's this true. Softer side.
Which is, it's funny in a way, like in a nice way, it's quite strange.
Yes.
Because we've never seen Kerry in this, I suppose, vulnerable position, which is, in a way, we never see her without the crutch. And what's the first thing that we see of her this week is the crutch leaning against a chair in the hotel room. So you're kind of going, your brain is like, hotel, crutch is there, which means she's not walking. And then Ellis walks out. You're like, okay. What a very Merry Christmas to you, Kerry.
And doesn't she deserve it? And then, as you say, you know, she has that lovely, she does have that nice moment with Jeannie, and hopefully things are thawing there. And then as we see her leave at the end, she's off with Ellis to the airport. You know, she hasn't got her bathing suit, but it doesn't matter because he knows some private places where she won't need her bathing suit. And it's good to see her happy and doing something different for once, not just being all work, no play. She kind of deserves that. I mean, I don't know how I feel about this guy, but if he's making her happy for this moment, I'm going to accept that.
There is a snake oil salesman element to him, but in their interactions, you can kind of see, well, maybe. You never know.
Yeah.
Now, unfortunately, we kind of do know, but still, kind of like, well, maybe this is a nice thing. But what would make me worried is that this Kerry, who we never see vulnerable, you know, never really sees somebody, you know, in her heart. Don't be a baddie. Don't hurt her, because I think that might put up some walls.
Yeah, that will be harder to knock down again. And he's got that. He's got that. I'm going to sell you in a, what's that episode of The Simpsons when they sell them the train that goes right?
Oh, the monorail.
That's it. Monorail. That's who he reminds me of. I'm waiting for him to put on the hat and start singing. But there you go.
Phil Hartman that voiced.
And then we've got Carol this week. So, you know, we've seen her be very vulnerable with Doug and kind of earlier, and Doug's ready to tell the world and she's still not, but she's trying to get the day off. So she keeps asking all the different nurses, and at different times they're all saying no. Toonie sounds like she's going to have an amazing Christmas. She's off, you know, to sit in hot tubs and go skiing, which, you know, with some handsome man, which I thought, go Toonie, you know, she lives, that woman. She lives. We meet, so she's actually there to help when the little boy comes in, and we meet the firefighter Greg Powell, who's all, you know, covered in soot, and later he's just all being hunky and God, you know, Greek godlike, standing kind of, I need clothing, you know.
No, you don't. Sorry, I'm just saying what we're all thinking.
I felt like Carol was feeling a bit flustered, wasn't she, by him? Yeah. You know, she was a bit like, I can go to Lost and Found and get you, you know, this handsome man trained his eyes on her, which it was nice to see her be a bit flustered. And
I mean, wouldn't you be?
Yes.
And I did have the opinion that maybe, do you see what I see, is actually what Toonie and Lay was saying to each other when he was just strutting around with his nipples on show.
Because I bet they got rid of all the clothes that were around for nearby. Yeah. They were just like, if we just get hide all of this, the scrubs and everything, he'll just have to walk
burn
around.
Everything, hide them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Here you go, kids, Christmas, have scrubs. It's you know, so he's there being a bit sexy and flirtatious, and he may come back, he may not, we're not sure. And then Connie finally says, hello, you know, here I am. I'm seeing Gladys Knight. I need to swap my shift. So she gets the day off. So she runs to tell Doug and she says, I've done it. I've got the day off. He said, oh no, because I've actually switched with Anna so that I could work
together. Oh my God.
And she's like, no. And he's like, I'm kidding. And I love that.
Yeah.
I thought that was absolutely brilliant. And that's it. She's decided she's going to tell everyone. She's going to go out. She's going to make the announcement. She gets everybody quiet. She says out loud that they're together. They have been for a while. Everybody's like, okay, we knew. And they all start paying Connie because they all had a pool. Connie was right.
I love it. Pay up. Oh, it's brilliant.
Yeah. And Chidi's like, oh, damn, I thought it was going to be New Year's for sure. He's like that, you know, worst kept secret in the world kind of thing. And I wonder if actually they were ribbing her a bit about not having anything to do and not having a life because they were wanting her to be like, actually, I've got a dog.
Just ask. We know you want to spend it with Doug. Yeah. Just ask. Yeah, exactly. So that we can tell. Yeah.
Oh. And then because he always has to upstage her, he says, I want everybody to help me convince her to marry me.
Oh, it's so awkward.
I got that. And I love Doug, but I got that feeling too.
I loved it. I'm sorry. I think
Carol did too. She's arms around him, plants a kiss on him. So, you know, but it did seem like, I don't know, Doug.
Did she say yes, though?
She did not say yes.
I don't think she thought he was being serious. That's why. He's such a joker about stuff. And I think that's what the joke ahead of this moment was, because I feel like it comes up a bit later. He's like, I did ask you, and she's like, no, you didn't. And
there, okay, that makes sense.
Yeah, so you know, he's basically standing there, all the things that she's been afraid of. He's basically stood in front of all these people and gone, well, actually, I want to marry this woman. That's real. You know, and she says, oh, you know, you have to upstage me, and they have a cute little moment. But the news is out. It's out. We know. And they're going to spend Christmas together, which is so sweet and cute. And then, as we say, you know, it ends on that lovely little montage of kind of people are throwing snow. We see some people, you know, we see Green being depressed. We see Corday with Alison. So that kind of ends it a nice little Christmassy gem of an episode.
And then and then the miracle worker. The miracle worker, even. The miracle
worker on Walker and everything
anyway,
else.
Exactly. Walks out. And it's lovely, I liked this episode.
Me too.
I think it's a good Christmas episode. I mean, the miracle thing was a bit... They don't normally go into that magical stuff. Generally, at Halloween, there isn't really a ghost. Do you know what I mean?
I feel like they do. I feel like it's a real American thing at Christmas. Yeah. They do get quite sentimental, and they will sometimes have a little kind of sprinkle of frivolity just to be like, it's different. It's Christmas. It's something a bit different. It's a bit magical. And I don't know. And I was here for it, I have to say. And I'm not normally, but I was like, I'll take it. I think Benton was a miracle man and could walk around. And I think if he touched those other men, they also would have been healed.
Phrasing.
I just do it on purpose to get to these two.
It works. Absolutely. You know it's got, it's going to get a reaction.
I do. Yeah. So should we do our Ibers?
Yeah.
As we said, Greg Powell, the firefighter. Yes. Played by George Eads, who used to be in, he was in CSI, which, you know, was everywhere. So maybe he wasn't in everything, it's just because CSI was everywhere. I haven't seen him around lately.
I think he's still in... No, he was in CSI up until 2015. He was in apparently 335 episodes of CSI.
My word.
From 2000 to 2015. I'm just like, I think that's enough.
You must
dial it back.
Bored after a bit. You must be like, oh God, not again.
Yeah. He's done a lot of voice work. So I mentioned in our WhatsApp, because I do like the Justice League cartoons of the early 2000s. He was Captain Atom. But he was also in Young Justice as well. Yeah, no, it's a ridiculous name, but yeah. But yeah, he's been in a lot of stuff, but mainly, I think it's just, you get stuck on CSI, don't you?
I think you do. I think that's just what you become, don't you, in a way?
Yeah.
I am CSI. CSI is me.
Exactly. That's what he says. Actually, if you look up CSI and see what CSI's been, that's probably with him. George is CSI now.
He's also in MacGyver, which as in the reboot of MacGyver.
Oh, God. Look at you.
Oh, okay.
in 59 episodes as Jack Dalton / Lincoln. I don't get why he's got two names in that, but unless he
once his like spy name or something, maybe.
I know it's in the unaired pilot he was called Lincoln and they changed his name to Jack Dalton.
Oh, I prefer Lincoln.
Yeah, Lincoln's a good name. Jack Dalton.
No, that's good too. No, cool.
Anyway, do you agree with that now? Do you?
I'm there.
Do you approve that?
I approve, Jack. Yeah, that's fine.
Yes, there's Georgie's, but then I noticed the cop, the female detective, was played by Stacey Travis, and it was really bugging me where I knew her from. And she was in two episodes of Angel, and for some reason, as we do with Iber, these faces get stuck in your brain and you have to root them out and work out where you know them from. And she played Senator Helen Brooker in the last two episodes of Angel.
That's right, you said that. Now, funnily enough, because I have Leland Crook, who played Bart, the blind guy who could see, he was also in Angel.
Was he?
He was the Archduke Sebastus. Again, yeah, the dude with the horns, and he's also in The Master of Disguise and NYPD Blue and Alias. But I remember seeing the name, I was like, I can't place that name, cannot place that name, and because he's in a lot of makeup in Angel, I didn't place him straight away. But yeah, that's so two season five Angel actors in the one episode.
Cool.
And considering I only got to think episode five of season one, I wouldn't know.
Yeah. Also, she was also in a film called Intolerable Cruelty with George Clooney.
Mr. Clooney.
Oh, yes, of course. Yeah.
Which is a Coen Brothers film, isn't it?
It is.
Yes. I should get around to watching more of those, but yes.
Okay, plan for the future.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's it for Ibers, I think, unless anyone's got any more.
No, I've no more after that. Do you, Sharon?
Nope.
Okay. So I was going to talk about our disease in focus or condition focus. So when they were testing Bart's vision, he was using that optokinetic drum, which is that drum they used for that lady who had hysterical blindness in the waiting area. Mm-hmm. And they mentioned optokinetic nystagmus. Now, nystagmus is a good word in itself, but it's something I know about from optical days. It's where you get, there's a condition of involuntary eye movement. And you can be born with it, but it usually does come on later in life.
Right.
And in many cases, result in reduced or limited vision. So the eye kind of quakes constantly. And that can either be vertical, horizontal, or circular. So your eyes can go I know it's pretty horrible. And there's two key forms, so pathological and physiological. And it can be caused by sleep deprivation, central nervous system disorders, if I can get my words out, also toxicity, drugs, alcohol. But yeah, it's if you go onto the Wikipedia page, there's some great GIFs of people with nystagmus. We can actually kind of see what we call voluntary nystagmus. So when you say you're on a train and you're looking through the window at the tunnel or whatever, yeah, exactly, the scenery. If you look at the window for a sec, you'll see your eyes kind of sort of flit from side to side as it's watching what's happening. So that, you know, our eyes do this anyway because, you know, that's how we track movement. But it's like a constant thing. So if you can imagine your optic nerve is trying to tell your brain that the whole world is shaking, what they do is they'll block that eye off in glasses. They'll put like an opaque thing through there. So your brain will hopefully automatically just use the other eye and rely on that eye that's not got the nystagmus to sort of take over a little bit.
Oh, okay. No, makes sense.
So yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, I do love my eye condition. I don't love them, but I'm interested in eye conditions and visual conditions. So yeah. It's bizarre.
And we're calling it. Thanks for listening to our podcast about everything ER. Don't forget you can find us on social media on Instagram at YouSetTheTonePod and at @set_pod on Twitter. Don't forget to rate, review and subscribe. And remember, you set the tone.